In several significant ways, this event is a first. It is the first symposium to be held in Seattle University Law School since the recent dedication of our magnificent new building. It is the first symposium of its kind ever to be held in the Great Northwest. Furthermore, law school and law review symposia typically focus more on free speech theory than they do on First Amendment in practice, as the Seattle University Law Review will be transcribing and publishing an account of this event. I thought it would be interesting to do a quick electronic search for free speech symposia in law journal literature. To my knowledge, then, this will be the first law review symposium to feature only prominent figures in the First Amendment libel trenches, those who face the daunting challenges of libel law on trial. Also, this will be the first video recording of an event of this type to be featured on the Jurist Internet website. Finally, this is surely the first symposium to gather this particular panel of distinguished libel law experts here today. Before I introduce them to you, allow me to comment briefly on one of the most dominant tensions in the libel law arena. Paul McMasters, the First Amendment Ombudsman for the Freedom Forum, succinctly captured this tension when he wrote, "There is much unsettled and unsettling about an area of law that so profoundly affects how journalists do their job and how the people get their news. On the one hand, libel suits are a necessary recourse for those who believe that they have been wronged by the press. On the other hand, even the threat of a libel suit can serve as a subtle censor of the press." It's difficult to disagree with McMasters. Individuals who claim reputational injury from news stories often point to the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark 1962 decision in New York Times versus Sullivan and its progeny to complain that too much legal protection has been guaranteed to the press. They feel that they're caught in a catch-22, just at the point that they enjoy enough public recognition to show a real injury to their reputation, they risk becoming public figures who are unlikely to prevail in litigation against the press. In contrast, recent developments demonstrate how the mere prospect of an expensive and time-consuming libel suit is often enough to drive the press to self-censorship. Excessive caution by publishers threatens to undermine the First Amendment goals for a free press, in the words of Justice William Brennan, uninhibited, robust, and wide-open public discourse. Consider only a few examples from the last few years. Oprah Winfrey, America's most popular TV talk show host, broadcast a program entitled Dangerous Food and was sued by Texas cattle ranchers in a federal district court who alleged that she libeled the beef industry. Winfrey prevailed at the trial level in that litigation, but for any defendant who is not as well healed as Oprah, the very threat of a product disparagement suit may be enough to silence the whistleblower. St. Martin's Press recently recalled a biography of presidential candidate George W. Bush entitled Fortunate Son that accused him of being arrested once on cocaine charges. The revelation contained in the afterword to the book was based on three anonymous sources. When the Bush campaign flatly denied the charges, and the identity of the author as a former felony convict was uncovered, the mass media struggled over whether or how to handle the events for fear of being accused of republishing a libel. It was internet-based journals like Salon and the Drudge Report, and not the traditional mass media, that were willing to break the story. Salon's senior vice president explained, "The internet generally isn't really interested in the corporate gatekeeper model of deciding what to publish." And there is also the Food Lion litigation, about which more will be said later. This afternoon, we are fortunate, indeed, we are honored to have five highly able and widely recognized experts to discuss these and other thorny issues pervasive in a libel law practice. Allow me now to introduce them. To my immediate right is Judge Robert S. Lasnik, who has sat on the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington since 1998. Judge Lasnik previously was Chief of Staff in the King County Prosecutor's Office and a King County Superior Court judge. He graduated with a master's degree in journalism from Northwestern University. To his right is Sandra S. Barron, the Executive Director of the Libel Defense Resource Center, a nonprofit membership organization of media entities, associations, foundations, insurers, and law firms nationwide, located in New York City. Ms. Barron oversees the association's promotion of First Amendment rights in libel, privacy, and related fields. She previously served as the senior managing attorney at NBC, as associate general counsel of the Educational Broadcasting Corporation, and as general counsel of American Playhouse. Moreover, she is the co-author of a major treatise on libel law. To her right is Ronald Collins, the director of FoodSpeak, a First Amendment project at the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington, D.C. Mr. Collins undertakes legislative and judicial battles against state food disparagement and product libel laws. He recently authored an amicus brief in support of Oprah Winfrey's defense in the beef libel case before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Many of you also know him as my co-author in our book, The Death of Discourse, and in our forthcoming work, Comedy on Trial, Lenny Bruce's Struggles for Free Speech. To his right is John Schaefer, one of the founding partners of O'Donnell and Schaefer in Los Angeles. Mr. Schaefer practices in the areas of intellectual property, entertainment law, and libel and privacy. He recently represented the writer Barbara Chase Reboud in her copyright claim against the film Amistad, and represented a consortium of journalists and newspapers in their successful effort to open to the public Jeffrey Katzenberg's compensation claim against Disney. And then finally, to his right is Bruce Johnson, a partner in the Seattle office of Davis Wright Tremaine. Mr. Johnson is well experienced in defamation and privacy defense, having represented the media in a number of First Amendment cases, including Oville versus CBS 60 Minutes and CBS versus Davis. Each panelist will now be given 5 minutes for an opening statement. These statements will highlight what, in their opinions, are the most prickly problems for libel law practitioners today. After these introductory remarks, the panel will engage in a roundtable discussion of several hypothetical scenarios that I will present to them. We will end the discussion so as to leave time for you to pose your own questions. And when that time comes, I hope that you will all exercise your First Amendment rights freely. Let us begin then with opening statements. Sandra, would you grace us, please?
Is this good enough? Is this close enough? I wanted to thank David Scover at Seattle University School of Law for inviting me to participate in the symposium on the litigation of libel. Because of my background, I tend to take a relatively pragmatic perspective. And what I see are a number of issues that make this litigation challenging for defendants. And let me go and set it all in this discussion as fraught with emotions on all sides of this divorce. I thought I would mention just three. One is the so-called libel by implication. The second is actual malice. And specifically here, because actual malice can cover a wide range of sins or issues in libel litigation, overcoming plaintiff's efforts to prove malice by the accumulation of circumstantial bits, a failure to interview a particular witness here, a failure to reach the plaintiff for comment there, piling them one on top of it, one another, hoping that the sum will equal actual malice. And finally, while perhaps not on Professor Scover's list of what he meant by difficult libel litigation issues, I think I should mention the high, if not prohibitive, cost of litigating libel cases. A matter that can be virtually determinative of libel litigation for small publishers and is a factor I would suggest in virtually every libel litigation. Then I'm going to double back a little bit and start with libel by implication. This is a complaint that can be brought even when much, if not all, of what is actually said in a publication is true or is not otherwise subject to liability. It is plaintiff's charge that the reader or the viewer or the listener can come away with an impression from the totality that is the fan force. I can tell you that when asked, media and defense counsel list this more than any other issue in libel litigation because it's really akin to shadow boxing. They're suddenly defending a statement that the reporter or writer didn't make, that he and his editors did not see, that you cannot perhaps defend as true, or even worse, your reporter believes may be false. The arguments, I can tell you, quickly play out in all sorts and various alternatives. You start with what did the story mean? Convincing the judge, or maybe a jury, it doesn't mean what plaintiff says it does. But the plaintiff's interpretation, while plausible, is not the most reasonable, or certainly not the only one. Or, if the implication is plausible, or it can be understood from the story, that it's protected opinion. Or, and ultimately, I would suggest to you this is how most cases are litigated, proving you weren't at fault in an actual malice case that you didn't know you were publishing a defamatory implication. I'm going to note that the press, I think, is increasingly winning the argument that at least in cases where actual malice is the standard, the plaintiff must prove that the defendant knew the implication was in the piece, as well as knew it was false. And in some jurisdictions, the courts have held the libel by implication simply can't be brought when the plaintiff is a public figure or a public official, or when the underlying facts in the story are true. These are not yet universal approaches, which takes me to actual malice, the second line issue. And because of the enormous cost of litigation, both in financial and in human terms, the utmost goal of most libel defendants is to win a case before trial, oftentimes on motions for summary judgment, and often on the issue of the inability of the plaintiff to prove that the defendant's published false defamatory statements of fact with actual malice. That is, for those of you who are not familiar with the actual malice standard, knowing that what was published was false, or with such reckless disregard of the truth as to be tantamount to knowing falsity. I think you can start from the premise that this standard is counterintuitive for some jurors, or for many jurors, and for some judges as well. There's a tendency, I think, to assume that if there's a mistake in the story, that it's the defendants that should suffer. And in some jurisdictions, I will tell you, judges, regardless of what they think of actual malice, are reluctant as a general matter to grant summary judgment motions. Moreover, I think you have to take as a given that every story, every book, and every article is going to have some flaws in the text or in the preparation, or most likely in both. These are, after all, human endeavors we are talking about. And, moreover, reporting has some altogether unattractive attributes. Sometimes reporters are heart-sounding, sometimes demanding, sometimes it's soft, it's sweet, when the end result is going to be a very hard-nosed investigative piece. Sometimes they use sources that judges and jurors don't like. There's always going to be more, I can assure you, the reporter could have done in preparation of the story. And without tapes in television, there will always be evidence of material that could have been included in the story. So then, what should constitute sufficient and adequate evidence to deny a defendant summary judgment on actual malice? That's the challenge for libel counsel to overcome, both initial antipathy for the actual malice standard, antipathy for summary judgment, to help the judge or the jury that comes to that understand how a reporter works, what's okay, even if unattractive in reporting, and what is acceptable and what is not as proof of actual malice.
Thank you. John, would you
I come from kind of the different background from my colleague, is that I'm a person who tends to be kind of in these libel cases, so I may hear me piping up a different, very different type of discussion. First, I think it's important to understand when we're talking about libel, we're talking about the First Amendment issues, understand the breadth of the issue that's being discussed. Most people like to focus on the area that is defendants like to focus on the area the strongest defendants. True journalistic reporting. But in actuality, libel is much broader than that. It's actually, I think, become even broader for a reason. Not only does it cover journalism, new media, the media, all these tough proliferation of television shows, but the kind of the ugly stepchild, the tabloid that we always hear about, the libel law and its application of tabloid. An area I've been involved in a lot recently is books, which pose even different issues in terms of libel. Typically, in most journalism, there's a rush to get the story out because news has a short time frame. When you're dealing with a book, you usually have a longer time frame associated with that, and as a person representing the plaintiffs in these issues, the approach to a book tends to be very different than the approach to a newspaper story. Finally, the one I'm finding most interesting now is in the area of entertainment. I was talking to my colleagues this morning about an instance that came up in my practice recently. I represent a pharmaceutical company called Pfizer. I don't know if you all saw, I think last season there was a Law and Order show involving Julia Roberts. Well, in that show, Julia Roberts tries to kill her lover using one of my client's drugs, Viagra. Well, does that pose any libel type issues? Well, I'm also defending litigation for Pfizer right now because people are claiming a causal relationship heart attacks and ingestion of Viagra. Was there any basis for Law and Order to do this? Law and Order is also interesting because a lot of its stories, they tend to put themselves out as being reality-based or stories based somehow on truth. Did viewers take away from that a belief that Viagra actually could cause cancer? Ultimately, we decided it didn't make any sense to serve. That really comes to, I think, the main point that you'll hear from my perspective is, despite the lamenting you'll hear from my colleagues on the defense side, the decks are about as stacked against me as they possibly could ever be. Probably the most important point is the notion of publicity. When my client has been, or believes it, they come to me and they say, oh, I've been defamed by this piece on 2020, or by this piece of journalism, and I want to sue, the first thing you do by doing that is you draw significantly more media attention to the story than probably was there before. A good example is that new movie, The Insider. You're seeing all these Brian Williamson ads saying, this movie's not true because of X, Y, Z, and all these other reasons. Well, you're creating controversy, you're creating advertising for the show, more people are going to go see it, more people are going to hear the bad statements. Those statements you believe are problematic. What's also interesting is libel actions live a lot longer than a media story. The public's attention is about 5-10 minutes for these types of stories in the newspaper. When you sue, it goes on forever. I mean, one of the great examples always cited is, you know, Carol Burnett's great victory over the tabloids, who many, many years ago, you know, accused her of being drunk in some restaurant. That litigation went on for like 5 or 6 years. And even though I think she ultimately settled and went back and forth all over the place, that story was in the public consciousness. Every time there was a decision, oh yeah, that's the story of Carol Burnett getting drunk. You have the issue of expense that was raised. Defendants, these big media companies always complain about how expensive these types of claims are. They're also very, very expensive from the plaintiff's perspective, many of whom tend to be individuals. Sure, people, there was an article recently in the Atlantic, it was in August, about a group of lawyers in Los Angeles who do this tabloid type on litigation on behalf of stars. Well, if you look at most of those cases drag out for long periods of time. While the star may ultimately prevail, the star's awarded, you know, $100,000, $2, whatever it is, to the point that clearly it was much more expensive to prosecute this than the ultimate result achieved. And finally, let's look at what happens with these cases. The public's attention to these types of cases is very short. First of all, my client's upset because the story's not true. Well, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. The press or the defendant can't prevail even if the story's false. It only matters if they consciously know it was false or reckless. Additionally, for public figures, it's very, very difficult to get an award of damages. So let's look at the results of the case. I can prove the statement was false, but lose because it wasn't reckless, so the public perceives the story as being true. I can win proving actual malice, but be awarded little or nominal damages. The public still believes that the media has prevailed the way they spread the story. So in most instances, I tend to avoid bringing these types of things. I'll get to a bit on what the things we tend to do now to address these concerns before they actually become litigation. But I do think it's important to understand perception. People in the media business believe right now, because of the state of law, that they're under siege by litigation that is restricting First Amendment rights among the press. I think it's been very important for us to understand that freedom of the press is broader in the United States than any country in the world. And while there may be some nibbling back at the corners, I mean, we are nowhere compared to, look at England, where Tom Cruise recently prevailed on his claim. And I do believe that there is some public perception, very anti-media perception. But I think when you look at it, there is a level of, the public perceives a level of arrogance amongst the media. And I can come here and make a bold statement that I'm actually the advocate of the public in these claims, in all respects except one, which is the public's right to know. But you do see a real clash between the public's right to know and the public's belief that there are notions of privacy that are held by all of us. And many times, the media can lie, cheat, steal to get a story, and the public sees that as well. So what's the problem I'm seeing here? I think the problem we're seeing today goes back to kind of an Einstein-type notion. There's a problem of mass and velocity. Right now, there's a lot more information coming out, and the rush to get it out is intense. So whereas previously you had a length of time to tell your story, you tell it in a couple of pages. Now it's in sound bites. You may have 100 facts in a moment to tell the complete story. The newspaper editor can only choose 5 or 10 of those. And obviously he's going to spin those facts in a manner that will draw interest to their story. That is where the conflict comes. So what am I doing now? Well, typically what I do in many of these cases is that I try to get the story before the story goes to press. Worked many times with books. I represented a prominent music publisher who was being defamed horribly in a book that was about to come out. We were able to get to the book before it came out, resolve a lot of the issues to the point that the book became very boring. But our battle was the book publisher wanted these sensational facts in there and wanted to use our controversy as a basis to sell books. There we were successful because I doubt anyone in this room ever read the book. The book came out, no one knows who I represented, so I think we were successful. The last thing I do, and I know my time's running out, the last thing we do now in this broader economy we have now is we sue in other countries. I've advised clients to sue in France. I've advised clients to sue in Ireland, where the First Amendment rights are not withdrawn. And we're prevailing in those. So these multinational corporations who have great protection in the United States don't have those protections in the other countries. And I think that's going to be a real fertile ground on how this law of defamation might work.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Chalasny, could you?
Thank you. My perspective, of course, as a jurist watching some of these cases come through, it's different than the advocates here, but it's very representative of what you see, is that each one tries to cloak their side with truth and justice in the American way, and each one attempts to posture themselves as sort of the little guy up against the big enemy. And when you represent 60 CBS or the New York Times, it's hard to convey the impression that you're a little guy. But even when the media client is a little guy, I think you'll see that the lawyers who represent the media try to keep be aware of every case out there, because the wrong case that goes up with a, without proper representation can affect their clients down the road. So they're, if you pick a fight with any media organization, you should expect to have a nuclear war on your hands. And a case that I handled with Bruce's law firm, it looked like a very small case, involved the Seattle Weekly, a person who was not a particularly famous person, who just felt that he was treated very shabbily in a particular article. And a sole practitioner, plaintiff's lawyer, took the case for him. And the discovery that ensued over the next few months was so overwhelming to this lawyer and so pervasive about the background of the plaintiff. He's seeking damages that opens up all sorts of areas of his background for questioning about tax returns and financial dealings and whatever. I think by the time I granted the summary judgment for the media, I think the plaintiff and his lawyer were relieved to get out of the case. They couldn't just withdraw, but they certainly were not anxious to fight again another day. The other thing, I've had a lot of experience as the chair of the Benchmark Press Fire Brigade in the state of Washington to try to put out flare-ups that occur in the courtroom revolving around media issues. And I think I have a lot of friends in the media. The one time they cringe is when I'm doing a case and I'm talking to a jury ahead of time, and the issue is pretrial publicity and do we need to close the courtroom, do we need to move the trial and the like. I engage in a little discussion with the potential jurors about how many of them have ever had something that they were personally involved with covered by a newspaper or television. And you know, most people's hands will go up. Something happened at their school or their job or that they were involved in. And then I say, in those circumstances, how many times did the media get it right and nobody's hand goes up? And I say, well, why do you expect that they got it right in this case either? So just set aside whatever you read about this particular case, and we'll just move forward. And the heads nod, and they say, yeah, you know, that's true. So the media wins because they get to stay, but they always come up to me afterwards and say, I don't know whether I really like the way you did that, Judge, but we are glad we get to stay in the courtroom and cover it. I think it's fair to say that the media does not hold a very high regard in the public for accuracy, for fairness, for the things that they aspire to. There are many reasons for that, some we can talk about here today. But the fact of the matter is, I think when you come right down to what makes this a great country in terms of our government system, two of the things you have to look at are an independent judiciary, which is virtually unique, and freedom of the press and freedom of expression in the First Amendment, which likewise is almost unique in the world.
Thank you. Bruce, would you give us your statement?
I'd like to divide my statement into three parts. The first part I'll call context and inspiration. The second part I call kvetching. And the third part I call fears about the future. Let me start with context and inspiration. It is important for us to recognize and never forget that modern press freedom was a gift to the civil rights movement. The extent to which the American media forget this is not a great corporate success story, but is in fact the success wrought by very, very hardworking, struggling people who battled largely in the South, but also in the North, for civil rights laws a generation ago, cannot be overstressed. And when you defend a libel case, when you have to stand in front of a jury, it's very important to remember that this is a right which was won for all of us. Not by simply corporations, but by individuals who were struggling. This was brought home to me 3 weeks ago when I made a presentation in Warsaw as a guest of the Polish Journalists Association and the Polish Press Freedom Monitoring Center. I was asked to discuss American press law to these journalists who came not simply from Poland, but also from Hungary, Belarus, Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Czech Republic, and even Russia. This was 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. One of the people I spoke to on that trip, a friend of mine in Latvia, recalls a cold Christmas night in Riga many years ago when she happened to break out in a song that she had heard somewhere, which was Silent Night. This was in the USSR. Two of her colleagues quickly cautioned her not to use that song and to quiet down immediately because she could be reported for singing Silent Night. When I made my presentation to the Polish gathering, I was trying to explain American press law and American press freedom, and said, I don't know if I am the one to explain press freedom to you. Within the last 10 years, you have reconstructed civil society. You have created morality. You have brought to bear within the Soviet Empire something which is not simply uninhibited, robust, and wide open, but something that goes to the heart of all of us. So I felt fairly modest in talking about press freedom. But the Poles, the Eastern Europeans, looked at me and said, when we were on the Gdańsk shipyards in 1980 and 1981, we sang, "We shall overcome." All of this press freedom in the United States, and indeed in Europe, and in the former Soviet Union, is of one cloth. It comes from people being willing to struggle, not simply the media, but all of us willing to struggle for our rights. One of the points ironically made by the journalists in this gathering was, well, we struggle for our rights, but nobody's reading us now. They're living in a very typical, very modern, normal society again, and folks are tuning them out, oddly enough. And that was one of the major complaints. They also complained about their salaries. So we are clearly arriving at Western society bit by bit. But it's important to remember that inspiration, because New York Times versus Sullivan was itself the product of a struggle to call attention to very important injustices in this country. Kvetching. I'm going to divide my kvetching into three different categories. First, the law. The largest single concern I have about the law dealing with the media arises from a 1991 U.S. Supreme Court case, Cohen versus Kohl's Media. It concerned a Minnesota newspaper which decided to reveal the name of a confidential source. And the U.S. Supreme Court held that the First Amendment did not bar a state law claim for promissory estoppel by that source against the newspaper. The court went on to hold that the First Amendment is not implicated when laws of general applicability are used against the media in connection with news gathering torts. That area of the law is still very unsettled, as recent decisions, including the Food Lion case within the last month, will show you. But it's not just the law, it's judges and it's jurors. Abner Mikva, when he left the DC Circuit bench and became White House counsel, told the media, watch out, there is a backlash among the judges. Last week, Nina Totenberg, NPR reporter, gave a speech in New York. She talked about the Supreme Court's attitude in the media, and it was very succinct. She said, they hate us. She described it as similar to Jackie Gleason's comment, one of these days, Alice, it's going to be pow right in the kisser. But it's not just judges. Jurors also are reflecting attitudes of distrust and alienation from the media. Floyd Abrams, a leading First Amendment lawyer last week, said, in his view, the press will pay dearly for the Bill and Monica story. In a recent survey of Americans sponsored by Freedom Forum, 53% of respondents said that the press has too much freedom. That's a majority. And this is up from 38% in 1997, 2 years, from 1997 to 1999, 38% to 53%. In the same study, 65% of Americans say that the press should be free to publish freely without government approval of a story. Isn't that nice? That's down from 80% 2 years earlier. And those supporting the media's right to report government secrets, a basic First Amendment tenet, have dropped from 61% to 48%, not even a majority now. So we're starting to discover that people are reflecting some of these concerns that some of the other panelists have mentioned about the media. Finally, the future. The future is largely the internet. The internet provides an opportunity for the graffiti on the bathroom door to appear worldwide. We have a leading internet journalist, Matt Drudge, who proudly claims that he gets his facts right 80% of the time. One commentator has characterized the internet as the net of 1,000 lies. And in the future, if the internet continues as it appears to be moving, everyone, you, I, and everyone in this room, will have an opportunity to be a reporter, but nobody will be an editor. And that will have profound consequences for the quality of the discourse, the quality of the information, and potentially for liability. Finally, with regard to the internet, and John mentioned it briefly, it's an international phenomenon. One of my partners handled a case recently where a libel judgment from the UK, where the plaintiff in a libel judgment in the UK sought to obtain enforcement in Maryland, in the Maryland Court of Appeals, in a decision which rang of Patrick Henry and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin said, not in America, we don't have that kind of thing here. We have the burden of proof on the plaintiff, not on the defendant. And refused to enforce the judgment. But that particular defendant had the opportunity to fight this battle because it did not have any resources in the UK. If you're the Wall Street Journal in Singapore, Time Magazine in the UK, or virtually anyone in France, you will have to fight those battles where they arise. When John brings the battles, they will likely take place there. So we're likely to see international libel law to a degree that we would never have expected 25 years ago, which leads me back to the original point, and that was that all of us are in this together, and that what happened in Montgomery, Alabama, 35 years ago, is very important not only for Warsaw today, but hopefully for other countries around the world, and I hope we don't forget it. Thanks.
John?
Well, it's wonderful to be back in the Pacific Northwest and to have left one Washington on the East Coast and come to the other one here on the West Coast. And a big thank you to Seattle University, where I had the privilege of teaching as a visitor sometime back then, and have me here again. Pretty much what you've heard today might lead you to believe that the fight, if you will, this First Amendment fight involving issues of libel, is between the media, that is the defense bar on the one hand, as represented here before you by Sandra, and on the other hand by the plaintiff's bar, by John. John has said that the deck is stacked. Indeed, it may be. The question that I think you have to consider is, if that is a true statement, just how is it stacked? You know, who is favored by this deck? As someone who works for a public interest group, I don't feel beholden to media groups on the one hand or the tennis bar, or money to bar on the other. I feel that there is a public interest at stake here, public interest in the First Amendment. In fact, it was Perry Calvin, the man who wrote, and I recommended to you, a very famous book, or at least once that there was a time that's been read, called The Negro and the First Amendment. It talks about the issues that you mentioned. But he talked about the First Amendment as being essentially very important to the citizen. The citizen as critic, the citizen as consumer, the citizen who could take that right and exercise it in a way that he or she could become a better citizen. At least that was the idea. Well, from that vantage point, how does the First Amendment work in a context where you, the public, you, the people, are to receive information? Are you receiving more information? Are you receiving information of better quality, decisions, information that will help you make an informed decision?
Niccolo Machiavelli, a dead political philosopher, once said that others will tell you what should be, but I will tell you what is. Centuries later, the comic satirist Lenny Bruce echoed those remarks, this while he was being carted off to jail for mouthing obscene words. Now, without yielding to undue cynicism, it is well to keep in mind the lessons of realism, especially in the face of elevated idealism. It is well to know the law and the lesson as printed in the New York Times against Sullivan. But it is equally important to know the realism of that case, how it translates in practice, how it translates in courtrooms, how it translates in lawyers' offices, how it translates in that dynamic between lawyer and author or activist as to what can or cannot, or what should or should not be said. Now, you know from reading New York Times against Sullivan that as a practical matter, you know that seditious libel is dead better wrong. You've read the case, and as a practical matter, you know that. In other words, seditious libel is something that people in Thomas Jefferson's day have to worry about. Who worries about seditious libel anymore? We can say whatever we want about Bill Clinton, and we do. Well, we do have a seditious libel. But ironically, it's no longer as much concerns with rulers as with rutabagas. Let me explain. Believe it or not, for those of you who are may venture to Colorado, it is a crime. It is a crime. It is against the law, ladies and gentlemen. It is against the penal law to disparage food in Colorado. Think about it. You can make remarks about a lemon and find yourself in a slam. Now, this law wasn't something that traced back to the 18th century. It was passed in this very decade. It makes it a crime to speak ill of food. Now, it makes you wonder, when you think about this, and you think about people in Colorado and what they may or may not say about food, it makes you wonder, indeed, the neck is stacked. But against whom is it stacked? Again, in fact, so much of what takes place, we assume, in fact, we're taught in law school that you don't really have a legal issue unless there's litigation. Au contraire, quite often the case is that the laws are so stacked that one thinks twice before making a statement. In other words, one self-censors. Well, the bad news is Colorado. The good news, and this reveals just how relative things are, the good news is that in 12 other states, it is just a civil wrong to speak ill of white conservatives. For example, if you're in Alabama, you cannot go to jail for criticizing an agricultural product. You can only be sued for general and punitive damages. And in Ohio, not only can you be sued for general and punitive damages, but you can be sued for the successful plaintiff can obtain attorney's fees. Notice I said the successful plaintiff, not the successful defendant. Now, from the vantage point of consumer information, from the vantage point of your, if you will, right to know uninhibited, robust, wide open information, how much information can be conveyed to you if in Colorado you can go to jail for saying certain things disparaging? This food may be dangerous for X, Y, and Z. In Alabama, you can be sued for punitive damages. In Ohio, punitive damages plus attorney's fees, etc., etc. Now, my experience in the public interest world
is that a lot of times reporters or activists or others will come to me and say, can I say this about a particular product? Not about product X, Y, Z, but just generally about oranges or what have you. And I have to say, yes, you can say it. This is a free country. This is America. Stand on your First Amendment rights. Now, it may take 3 years of litigation. All right? The Oprah case, you all know that. Oprah, she won the case. At the end, there was that glorious statement, the First Amendment rocks. Okay? Well, sure it rocks. You know, it's rocking to the tune of millions of dollars of litigation. That case in its 45th month of litigation. 45 months of litigation. 70-some volumes of trial transcripts. Millions of dollars in attorney's fees. Why? Because Oprah and Howard Lyman and others said something about cattle, or about hamburger. The whole issue that has been litigated, and this gives you an idea, Sandra Barron has mentioned about the cost of litigation. This case, ladies and gentlemen, has been argued for 45 months. It's before the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And the sole issue before the court, or the major issue, they haven't reached the First Amendment. Justice Brennan and New York Times versus Sullivan, that's still a decade away. The sole issue before that court are live cattle, cattle on the hoof. Are they an agricultural product within the meaning of the statute? Most activists, most of the people that work with Ralph Nader, my colleagues in arms, cannot afford that kind of litigation. They cannot afford to in that circumstance. Indeed, I agree, John. The decks are stacked. Of course, how they're stacked is another matter. Well, we have a number of hypotheticals here today, but I think it's important to keep in mind there is, if you will, the idealism, and I think it's a very hearty and important idealism, that you find in reading cases, in reading, I think, very important and inspiring cases like New York Times versus Sullivan. But there is also the reality of how those cases, day in and day out, become law in people's lives in terms of the courtroom, in terms of the office, and in terms of the decision as to what a person should or shouldn't say, given what he or she may confront. Again, Niccolo Machiavelli will say, others will tell you what should be, I will tell you what is. I hope today we'll have a lot of discussion about the what is.
Thank you. Now, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, you can see how lively, informative, and entertaining a discussion we're likely to have. The panelists have been informed that this is not Jerry Springer, and they're not allowed to throw chairs or to assault one another physically, but certainly a little bit of mental assault is expected. Let us now proceed to our first scenario, the case of libel by fiction. David Lodge's novel on ideas, sex, and politics in current academic circles of rhetorical studies entitled Small World introduces a character named Professor Zach, one of the most celebrated postmodern theorists on the lecture circuit. Zach is a rather conceited and opportunistic type who takes full advantage of the sexual favors that are offered to him by fawning graduate students. For those in the know, Zach's ideas with respect to text and meaning appear virtually identical to those of a real world postmodern scholar, Stanley Fish. Although Zapp is not described as bearing the same physical characteristics as Stanley Fish, soon the buzz rages within and outside of rhetorical departments that Zapp is meant to be Fish. Even legal academics begin to notice the similarities in their intellectual agendas, like Professor Pierre Schlapp, the former professor here at Seattle University Law School, who wrote an article entitled Fish versus Zapp. Those facts that I've just stated are true. The following are the hypothetical facts. Now, assume that at university cocktail parties and academic conferences, Stanley Fish is increasingly subjected to mean-spirited teasing, unkind comments, run the full gamut from the merely irritating it's a small world, isn't it, Stanley? To the utterly embarrassing and leering wink, wink, now, hey, Zap, how do you have time for all that extracurricular activity? Finally, after a particularly graphic and perverse comment, Fish is pushed over the edge, and he consults an attorney about a libel suit against David Lodge, the creator of the character Zap. In the postmodern world of fiction, where we merge the boundaries between fiction and nonfiction all of the time, Hamlet, what do you perceive to be Fish's realistic and appropriate prospects of recovery for libel by fiction? Anyway.
I guess I can just start since I'm the person that the professor would come to see. Really, this is the issue of whether or not there's an association with the real character. I like this case from a libel perspective for a particular reason. One of the greatest hurdles to get over is actual malice. And I've got active, if I can make the link, if I can show people associating the Zap character with Stanley Fish, I've got actual malice, or an easy case to the jury of actual malice. Problem I see, though, is the narrowness of this of the group you're talking about here. I mean, how many people study postmodernism? How am I going to sell this postmodernist rhetoric to a bunch of postal workers on a jury? And the other problem you have with the case is the linkage of the theory with the sexual conduct. Are people going to associate Stanley Fish with the sexual conduct? But in terms of a libel case, this is one that I would like more than most.
As I guess a representative of the defense counsel, let me just give you some basics about the law. I mean, the fact is that what John is not telling you, I think clear enough, is that he has to make the case that this book is of and concerning his client. That's a basic in libel law. It's one of the first issues that you have to face. Now, as a general matter, it's not very difficult to prove of and concerning. Newspaper reports that the mayor of Seattle is taking bribes. It's not hard to figure out who it's of and concerning. But when you deal with a fictional case like this, I think John may have some serious difficulties, particularly if the depiction of our fictional professor really is different in like, in kind, but for ideas. Approving that this book is really of and concerning his mind.
Well, let's say, how do I do that real quickly? That's all I have to do is bring in David Lodge's friends and associates and have them say how much David hates Stanley Fish, how much he's jealous of this guy, how he wants to destroy his reputation, and I am beginning to make a circumstantial case of of and concerning. If I don't have that evidence, and I'm simply left with this, I've got a hard case.
Of course, the other concerning requirement, a requirement that is a very important portion of New York Times versus Sullivan, which is deleted from many casebooks of constitutional law, this core requirement that says it's not enough to attempt to libel somebody generally. It has to be particularized. A particular person, particular time, particular place, some clear identity. Well, I would like to be a little bit more specific here. If you have Stanley Fish criticized here, and Stanley Fish criticized here, is it Fish's academic writing? You know, does the criticism run from Fish, criticism of Fish as academic writing on academic writing? You know, is that the lexus? Is that the link? Or is it Fish academic, Fish, if you will, pervert? You see? In other words, it may well be, I may well grant what John says, yes, he's very critical of Stanley Fish, you know, but only as an academic writer, all right? This other matter is totally unrelated. I never intended to, there's no link, if you will, between the academic criticism and this other matter.
Can I just note that just in this little brief back and forth, you've already gotten a hint at why libel litigation is so long and so costly. Did you hear the word discovery in John's voice, or at least, because he's going to want to know a whole lot if I'm representing the writer, about what he knew, what he thought, what he felt, what he's ever written before, and what he's ever done. And that's not the beginning of what we're going to want to know from his client. So you might want to listen for that as we talk about these issues and the extent to which the litigation process, which, by the way, in international law, you'll find there is very little discovery, at least a lot less, and that's an enormous detriment to at least defendants. I can't speak to plaintiffs. So while I'm critical on some level of the cost of libel litigation, I'm enormously grateful for the benefits of the American system.
Well, let's think about that discovery issue. Yeah, I may have to discover what David Lodge thinks of Stanley Fish, but hopefully none of these people would know, but I assume many other people defending, what are they going to do to my client? They're going to go after and see if this stuff's true or not. They're going to dig up everything they got, because maybe actually is a perpetration.
There are some plaintiffs who are actually libel-proof plaintiffs because they're so their reputation is already so terrible. There isn't anything you can do to drag them down any lower. And certainly, a vigorous defense counsel will attempt to probe and see if this particular plaintiff might fit in that category.
Of course, Judge, you're not implying anything about Stanley Fish in your comments, right? We have to make sure that Stanley Fish is not liable here today.
Well, I've actually really had just had that instance involving a recent ad campaign by Reebok, where they had this ad, I don't know if anyone saw it, it was all that successful. They said, insane fighter held fit to fight. And they were worried that Mike Tyson was going to sue them. He was not going to sue them, I'd probably liable to.
One of my partners handled the case, involving the Globe newspaper tabloid. And the tabloid headline on the front said, "Cops think Cato did it." And to go inside to find out that they thought he had done perjury or committed perjury.
No, it damaged the Globe. The article was 17 pages
back. That's fine.
In smaller print.
One of the problems with the oven concerning test is the Vigo test. My eyes glaze over. I have tried to explain the of and concerning rule to judges, and I can assure you it is not an easy one to explain or to fit into the litigation model. And as a matter of fact, one of the points that I think underlines John's statement is that once the plaintiff gets past of and concerning, which may not be that hard if it's a judge who is not particularly thoughtful, or thinking, he may actually have a straight shot at a jury verdict of substantial money. Because under an actual malice test, if I am writing a work which I know and believe to be fiction, the question can be posed to me as the author, did you believe this? No, it's not true. And you've suddenly got actual malice established as a matter of law because he didn't believe it at all. So the fictionalization cases present real risk if this of and concerning test or other tests are not adequately applied early on. If they aren't, you can find yourself in front of a jury with the potential for a large adverse judgment.
Given what Bruce just said, you can see, I mean, you can go right to actual malice in terms of not to prove it. You can see that, in a sense, it makes no, it's no moment, no great moment, whether or not Stanley Fish is a public figure. Right? I mean, that added level of protection when you're dealing with public figures, if you can establish as readily as suggested by Bruce, malice, then even that doesn't help the situation.
Now, Ben, I'd like to give you a variation on this scenario. Would it make a difference in your analyses if an ultra-conservative political commentator who's long decried the consideration of Harvard law professor Lawrence Tron to the Supreme Court as a disaster to the country were to write a novel called Hypocritical Overtures? Hypocritical Overtures is about Harvard constitutional law professor named Larry Trine, who makes a harassing sexual overture to his female research assistant, similar in nature to those charged by Anita Hill, whom Tribe in fact defended, in Justice Clarence Thomas Senate's confirmation hearing. Pubic hairs on Coke cans and everything. Now assume that the copyright page of the book declares, quote, any similarities in the characters of this book to persons living or dead are merely coincidental. Also assume that in a magazine interview, the author explains that he always wanted to write a fiction story. and that this one neither intended to track or in fact tracked any of his prior political statements about Lawrence Tribe. What do you think about this scenario?
I guess I get to go first again. This raises another issue that if, in this instance, if the person was presenting the same facts and circumstances of Clarence Thomas, attributing them to Larry Tribe in this instance, it almost becomes a parody. I mean, you can write such outlandish things to ultimately raise a parody defense here. I do think that the 2 points that is trying to be raised by this variation also is whether or not the copyright, the claim of the copyright that this is supposed to be fictional and statements that are supposed to be fictional would have any bearing. I mean, to me, they're simply self-serving statements. It's really complex, the whole thing here is. I think this type of scenario is an important scenario because it does get beyond what the other said in the opening statement, is that libel addresses a number of things beyond true, good reporting. Why is someone writing something like this? Is it going to be a million-seller book, or is this a personal attack on someone that they're trying to get out there? And to what extent should it be more personal attack?
Let me ask the attorneys who practice in this area. Judges are always trying to get cases settled and avoid trials. What are the dynamics when you approach the issue of settlement or arbitration of some of these issues that are very different from the other kinds of cases?
The main difference, I think, is uncertainty in the damages. In most cases, particularly most civil and commercial cases, damages can be fairly easily estimated. Particularly in jurisdictions where you have punitive damages, this problem increases even more. As a consequence, you have the defendants coming in thinking this is not something that has a big number attached to it, and the plaintiffs coming in and saying this is something which is multi-gazillion dollars in damages, and that proves to be a very big hurdle for getting folks to arrive at a satisfactory settlement.
You kind of seek apologies more than money, and can you sometimes avoid a lengthy lawsuit if you just get an apology or a retraction?
A retraction many times it is helpful. Well, my experience in the media, having I'm on my both sides of this, but today I get to be the plaintiff. The media has a lot of issues above and beyond simply this one particular case that they can't be seen as someone who's going to settle every case that comes to them, and a lot of times they need to have some sort of presence. In a case like this, if this is a book that's out there, you want to keep this for public eye because you're going to sell more books. So it really depends on what the client is seeking. Many times the appropriate retraction for most of the people I represent is what that is sufficient.
Can I add to that?
Phil
John was saying that many media, at least the ones I've worked with, becomes a matter of principle. Principle on two levels. One, if you believe what you've reported, and now I'm thinking of the news organization or their book, if you believe what you reported, it's very difficult for a news organization to settle a case. There may be clarifications possible, there may be forms of statements a news organization can make that separate out what they think may have been an issue or may be wrong with the story, but a simple blanket may a culpa may not be from their perspective appropriate. And journalists take those kind of issues very seriously. Keep in mind, in a lot of cases, there are two sets of reputations at stake. More so, I think, than in any other kind of civil litigation. There's the plaintiff. But there's also the news organization or the publisher's reputation within the community for hopefully telling more truth than falsity.
In my experience, dealing in books or longer-term type articles, I think whatever you think is correct, that the news media really does want to get it right, so they will sit down with you. If you can show them something is just flat-out wrong, it'll be changed and corrected. The problem many times is the time isn't there to do it. Deadlines are approaching too quickly.
There are statutes, for example, that can encourage this process. California has a particularly helpful correction statute, which triggers the ability to eliminate punitive damages and certain other damages if there's a prompt retraction by the publisher. The Uniform Correction or Clarification of Defamation Act, I think it is,
is a proposed statute which has, I think, been passed by one or two jurisdictions so far by the Uniform Law Commissioners, and contains a very rigorous system for getting people early on to clarify the record and creates incentives to do so.
Just one thing that this hypothetical brings out, and it may begin to change your perspective. I think a lot of times when we think about libel law, the tendency is to think, well, you have the individual who makes the statement, and he or she is concerned whether or not they're going to be sued by something the plaintiff is for. This hypothetical, I would suggest, you know, the big concern a writer would have wouldn't be so much John suing him down the road. It would be dealing with the in-house counsel for the publisher. I mean, if you talk to writers, a lot of times they'll say, I mean, it's not so much the plaintiff's bar we're worried about. A lot of what we say can't get out there because the defense bar is so conservative, so worried, they won't allow us to put things in print, you know? They simply won't allow us to publish this book this way. I would think that these facts given here, you know, one of the things that might well be said is, this, you know, is a libel lawsuit waiting to happen. In other words, the matter would never get to John. It probably would never go beyond Bruce, right, for Sanders. But they would probably counsel against that. So from that vantage point, I mean, if you're a writer, right, you might think, well, who's really, for lack of a better word, censoring? Who's prohibiting me from saying what it is that I'm saying?
Thank you, Carlos. Let's move on to our next scenario, the case of Orange Outrage. Ultimate Oranges Company, a Florida grower and distributor of oranges, uses pesticides in the production of its crops. A local investigative reporter from KHTV does a story on the hazardous side effects of the pesticide on orange growers and pickers. This story relies on a government report that suggests some risks in exposure to the pesticide. Several industry-supported studies, however, categorically refute these findings. On her TV program, a government spokesman who's interviewed states, it is not known at this time what detrimental effects the use of such pesticides may have on consumers of oranges, but caution is always in order. And then the investigative reporter ends her segment with the comments of a flamboyant Hollywood movie star who states, I'll never eat Florida oranges again. Within days of the report, orange sales in the region plummet. Subsequently, Ultimate Oranges Company sues the reporter and her TV station under the common law of libel and Florida's food disparagement statute. So far as liability is concerned, what do you think of these facts, panelists?
I guess I get to go first.
John, would you pull yourself up, please? I want to make sure your valuable comments are heard.
First of all, I think I should apologize for the failing in my opening statement. I didn't anticipate the argument that was going to be made. I believe the deck is stacked against the plaintiff with respect to libel law. I think this is the perfect example of this. If I simply had a defamation claim with these facts, I would live. I mean, if there's someone expressing an opinion that I'm never going to eat an orange again, I'm not going to be able to do anything with that. But the interesting issue that really is unresolved now is what's going to be the status of these food disparagement laws, which agricultural producers are using as kind of, and I agree that there's even an end run around the First Amendment. I can't get into libel, I'm going to get into this unique thing called trade disparagement, and that's what has the media scared to death. As you pointed out, you can defame Bill Clinton, but you can't defame more.
At the risk of confusing apples and oranges, this bears a close resemblance to a case that I handled several years ago. What was puzzling about it is that the case which involved CBS 60 Minutes and the story about Alar is that the case law dealing with product disparagement generally, and even the case law regarding these agricultural disparagement statutes, is remarkably unclear. By contrast, libel law is a very stable body of law currently. So what we were faced with was a particularly unknown, unexplored territory where the guideposts, both legal and factual, are few. It took 6 years for that case to be disposed of, finally, from filing date in the Yakima County Superior Court to final denial of certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court. As it turned out, the basic problem was the plaintiff could never prove the broadcast was false, in part because scientists disagreed. And ultimately, it became a battle of experts. So you can imagine the cost of litigation involving 8 experts opining as to what might happen in the next 60 years should ALR have remained in our food supply. They were all over the map.
One of the things this hypothetical points out, and also what John said, you have, you know, two causes of action and the fourth cause of action. One, worker safety. The people who work with the president's office, does it in fact, you know, is it injurious to their health? And people who consume the product, oranges, that have the president's office in. From the vantage point of any cause of action, you know, so far as worker safety is concerned, that's probably a loser case. From the vantage point of criticizing oranges, if you will, think of it. The statutes, as they exist in Florida and elsewhere, if you're a reporter or a public interest advocate or whatever, it's not enough to say, I rely on a government report. But you think, you know, this is a government report, I can go out there and report on it. Well, you know, Ms. Smith, have you checked the other studies, the other political studies? Well, those are industry studies, industry reports, but have you checked them? Have you compared them? Well, I'm not a scientist. I have to get the information out of the public. I can't report about what the government says. You can report it, but you might be liable. Now, I believe these statutes are clearly unconstitutional, but in terms of the standards that they establish for someone making a statement and giving rise to liability, certainly this could be a real problem. Even when somebody is I think the statement is not known at this time what detrimental effects the use of such pesticides may have on consumer oranges. A statement very similar to this was made by a public interest advocate in Ohio about eggs, and she was hauled off to court. It was in court for a long time. Again, the question is, can you afford to stay in the game? Not can you afford to win, or not can you win, can you afford to fight the fight? And that's precisely in this kind of situation where it may be that at the end of the day you couldn't win, but somebody bringing an action might say you can't help but win, the other party can't win the action.
I think you have to look at it from the perspective of if an industry has ways to counteract bad publicity, advertising, press conferences, and the like. Why is this an effective way to even counteract that? Because our hypothetical has a regional local television reporter making a report and sales regionally plummet. Well, if you file a high-profile lawsuit and end up on national television, now you've distributed that negative information to a much wider audience, and you may see national sales of oranges go down. So in the equation of what is the purpose of the lawsuit, you're not going to get a quick resolution of a lawsuit in this day and age as it goes forward, and you could just generate more bad publicity.
Well, you can see the economic perspective coming from the agricultural community, in that if they see a precipitous drop in sales because of something they don't believe is true, they're looking for a remedy. They're looking to fashion some sort of prevention of that. I mean, and there is a broad spectrum here. I mean, the situation is fundamentally different if you're doing a product comparison. If I'm a maker of Clorox bleach and I decide to say that someone else's bleach is inferior for all these reasons, that supports a different type of cause of action under the Lanham Act than a reporter making adverse statements about somebody who's adverse to this stuff. But there is, I think everyone in the room should be able to see that there's a problem here, but can you fashion a remedy?
The British and the French can provide some guidance. Many years ago, it was uncovered that there was a risk of Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease by consuming British meat products. This is a variant of mad cow disease, which was the subject of the Oprah story. The British government taking additional steps, improve the meat supply, and the European Union basically certified British beef products throughout the European Union. The French decided no. This wasn't safe enough for the French, and they were going to outlaw all British meat products. Last month, the British came up with the perfect solution. There was a news article talking about the fact that the French dumped sewage into their chicken feed. And as a matter of fact, what happened at that point was the French products in Britain began to be the subject of a consumer boycott. They are in the process now of working things out. More speech is sometimes better than less speech in dealing with false speech.
You have to make sure that you're lively, competitive products, right? Competitive vegetables. Let us move now to the case of the little white lies. George Guy, a middle-level manager at Almus Chambers, a chemical manufacturing plant in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, contacts his friend, Amy Carey, who's a reporter at the La Crosse Daily Journal, a newspaper serving the greater Cooley region, including Eau Claire. George tips Amy off to worker safety violations that he suspects are occurring at a consistently increasing rate in his chemical plant. Assuming an alias and representing herself as an industry experienced professional, Amy is hired as George's secretary and spends 3 weeks at Almus Chambers secretly documenting and photographing questionable conditions and events. Leaving her secretarial post then, Amy writes a front page expose on incidents that the newspaper's legal counsel determines to be unquestionable worker safety violations under state and federal laws. At that point, Almus Chambers fires George Guy and sues him, Amy Carey, and the La Crosse Daily Journal in the Western Wisconsin Federal District Court, contending that the defendants perpetrated fraud and trespass in gathering information for their expose. Assuming, arguendo, that there were violations of state common law, the defendants raise by summary judgment motion a First Amendment defense to any such state law prohibitions. The defendants invoke the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals' recent ruling in the Food Lion case, a lawsuit that media attorney Floyd Abrams called an attempted end run around the First Amendment. Now, assuming that there is ample evidence to support a jury finding of state common law fraud and trespass penalties, should the press be immunized from such liability under the First Amendment's protection of news gathering privileges? Should journalists be allowed to tell small lies in order to report large private corporate wrongs, in your views?
Let me just raise the point I made in my talk, is that, well, the public likes to hear the ultimate story. They don't like the fact that reporters will lie, cheat, and steal to get to the story. Libel is not, again, not a good vehicle for pursuing these claims. So what was curious about this case is they came up with all these, they threw in all these common law torts in an effort to, as Floyd Abrams said, make an end run around the First Amendment. The issue comes down to is should reporters be treated differently than anyone else with respect to common tort liability?
I think the First Amendment bar is struggling probably more today, mightily, on this question of the relationship of the First Amendment to these common law torts than at almost any time in my experience in the practice of media law. Bruce mentioned Cohen v. Cowles. Cohen v. Cowles it is certainly the simple answer that a lot of plaintiffs' counsels, and I would suggest to you, not very thoughtful judges have applied in these instances without reading the majority opinion of the opinion in Cohen v. Cowles very carefully to see all that I believe it was Justice White had to say there about how these laws of general applicability can be applied to the press, provided that they only have incidental effects on news gathering, a not unimportant caveat I would commend to you when you read the case next, should you do so. The fact that the plaintiff is not trying to obtain reputational harm damages, something the courts, I think, are now consistently saying will not be allowed in these cases. But this, the word doctrinal is one I've always found difficult to get out, but perhaps in this instance, it's best applied. The doctrinal approach of applying the First Amendment to these claims, I think it's something that is very much right now a work in progress.
One of the interesting things about the Food Lion decision is that the jury awarded $5.5 million to the plaintiff, a large grocery chain in that particular case, and the Fourth Circuit reduced that to $2. Now consider the significance of a jury which basically treats a $2 claim as a $5.5 million claim in terms of the risk it presents to the press. But you should also think about the incentive structure built into this type of litigation now in the future. Will the plaintiff's lawyer really want to take a case where the contingency fee is 60 cents?
Well, in an instance like this, representing a major corporation probably would not be on a contingency basis. The interesting point that we were discussing beforehand is if I was bringing this type of a case, I may only sue for trespass and common law torts without any liable claim, and attempt to keep out of evidence the truth or veracity of what was actually said in the story. So keep the presentation of all the doctored meats and all the horrible things that may have actually been done in my work, and say, well, see, they just trespassed, so I should get an award.
I think don't overlook Doug's point about the not a contingency fee case. This is not an injury suffered by an injured party case as much as it is a corporate entity attempting to fight for its corporate life the same way it would in a commercial venture, and therefore would use a combination of probably internal counsel and corporate counsel with bringing in experts on how to make ends and runs around the First Amendment. And I think that I've not had to deal with this on the bench, and of course each case has to deal with that on its facts, but I think we as panelists can imagine the laws of general applicability that we don't want the media to violate, and we can imagine those that we do, and again go back to a civil disobedient sense. If the only way to really cover the story is to go on the to where the migrant workers live, which happens to be on the growers' grounds, to get the story, that's going to be looked at differently than a situation where the only reason you speak the hidden camera in there was not really to gather news, but because you're a television show, you have to have something visual. And so that's the justification for using the hidden camera.
I think there's an interesting tension that's going to go on in this litigation as it goes forward. The tension is going to be between the corporate desire, and these are generally corporations, large entities bringing this litigation, corporate desire. Not so much to get damages anymore, because that doesn't seem to be terribly likely in these cases from the press, but something to stop them from doing it. You're not going to come into my plant and show that I abuse my workers or I'm bad conditions, whatever it is that the press. And the way I'm going to stop you is by bringing this kind of litigation, and eventually the press will back off. They won't do undercover reporting anymore. Versus, I think, the other real reality, if you will, that a corporation has to face, which is, it's all well and good to say I'm only going to bring trespass and fraud claims, and you're never, as a jury, going to see this documentary which showed the bad conditions in my plant. But the fact is, that is going to be publicized. And by bringing this kind of claim, Food Lion, to use a real-life example, kept in the public eye for years and years after the ABC 2020 piece, the fact that they bleached chicken, and we're going to be able to put it back on the market after its due date expired. So I think there's going to be this very interesting within corporate headquarters back and forth between these two goals that may be mutually inconsistent.
I mean, given what's just been said, when something, I mean, think about what, and I think it's an excellent point that some of the plaintiffs are, who would obviously certainly consider, and that is that in a case, in a free speech case, you can imagine,
by just dropping the libel claim, leaving it alone, not touching it, the free speech issue vanishes, or at least the attempt is, have it vanished from the case. It's as if the baby has been thrown out the window and nobody sees, you know, what's fallen in the street. I mean, that precisely the idea that somehow you could have a free speech case litigated, if you will, almost divorced from the First Amendment. That, no, we don't want to talk about that. You know, that's really not an issue here. I mean, it's hard to make a free speech defense when the free speech is not part of the equation, when it's just simply a tort. And you know, we were talking about this earlier, and you know, maybe part of the concerns is that even when you have common law, and this is an idea that I just borrowed from Sandy, is that when you have common law, there has to be a certain First Amendment sensitivity, even as you apply common law doctrine to a situation. That in a sense, you cannot exclude the First Amendment simply because a cause of action has not completed.
Well, put on my defense hat real quickly. I mean, obviously, another way of looking at this, obviously, this entity is not suing because someone trespassed on their store. They're suing for damage to their reputation. They are suing because they're trying to vindicate their, albeit kind of a ridiculous way of doing it because they've kept the story in the press for a long time. That may be a new way for the courts to really look at this. Is the ultimate remedy sought reputation, even if people that's not to be awarded. And I think that's where the First Amendment sensitivity needs to come in. And just as it was said, we can all probably come up with torts in this type of instance where there is a need for relief other than rehabilitation reputation.
Well, there's an interesting print versus broadcast dilemma underlying this particular hypothetical. Historically, the news media have reported information provided to them by corporate insiders about such things as tainted food, bad meat, and the like. The print media will report those facts without too much fear of liability. The problem comes when the electronic media attempt to corroborate that information, to provide the visual that basically establishes once and for all that the problem is there. For some odd reason, the courts are creating a different rule of law, potentially, for the electronic media from disclosing the same information that we disclose with virtual impunity in a newspaper. I find that a very troubling distinction, but it's product of the technology, and I think our uncertainty about the dimensions of the technology and the risks associated with publicizing information that broadly, that effectively. And yet, from the standpoint of the media, to quote a recent Second Circuit case, this type of information provides uniquely objective evidence to support the points being made.
Thank you, panelists. Our last scenario for discussion today, the case of the cyberspace public figure. In contemporary constitutional law, the mass media are far less likely to be found liable to defamation if they focus on public figures rather than private ones. As you know, the public figure concept is tied to two premises. First, average citizens typically have more limited access to the mass media than public figures in order to combat false or misleading statements about them. And then second, individuals who thrust themselves into the common domain must expect their names to be bandied about a bit with greater frequency and with greater possibility of error. Now, based on these two premises, the question really is the traditional divide between public and private figures likely to be as sharp in cyberspace? Take then, panelists, the case of a conservative moralist who launches a website called Family Balance. In this website, the conservative moralist publishes his personal articles, and he provides real audio readings of his personal essays on the decline of Judeo-Christian marital and family relationships. The website catches the imagination and the attention of the fundamentalist right, and after a year of operation has become relatively renowned, receiving 1,000 some hits a day. subsequently, the conservative moralist is falsely accused of marital infidelity by the editor of an electronic column called Net Gossip, that is the liberal counterpart to the Drudge Report. Should the conservative moralist sue the editor of Net Gossip, Panels, do you believe he's entitled any longer to the law's protections for private figures?
That to me seems pretty straightforward and fairly simple. It seems to me that someone who takes the initiative and inserts himself or herself or itself, in the case of an entity, into controversial realm, as this gentleman has done, and has the ability to respond, to be sure, indeed, one could say, he picked the fight, is unlikely to be found to be a private figure, but correctly, I think, would be found to be a public figure.
I would look at it just a little bit different. I think the one thing the internet has done is really reduced the barriers by which an individual can respond. Right? The key fact here is that this person has a presence on the internet and therefore has the ability on the internet to respond to the internet community. I think you would be drawing a sharp distinction if the story was picked up in the New York Times and published to everyone as to whether or not he is a public figure in a media beyond the internet. And that's a distinction I'm not aware of any case ever drawn.
What's interesting is that I think Woody Allen's comment can be paraphrased. In the future, everyone will be a public figure for 15 minutes with the internet. When I said that all of us are reporters on the internet, all of us will probably also become public figures on the internet. What's interesting to see in the next 10 to 20 years is whether the law responds to this different dynamic. That the prototypical case is no longer the large media entity with large, significant financial resources and the ability to speak loudly and clearly across the nation versus a single plaintiff who has no access to the media to get his or her reputation corrected. We may find a leveling of the playing field and therefore a different paradigm with regard to libel law within 20 to 30 years, which I find to be a very interesting development.
If you're a public figure in cyberspace, cyberspace publication, are you perforce a public figure in print publication?
One who takes the initiative and inserts himself or herself or itself, in the case of an entity, into controversial realm, as this gentleman has done, and has the ability to respond, to be sure, indeed, one could say he picked the fight, is unlikely to be found to be a private figure, but correctly, I think, would be found to be a public figure.
I would look at it just a little bit different. I think the one thing the internet has done is really reduced the barriers by which an individual can respond. Right? The key fact here is that this person has a presence on the internet and therefore has the ability on the internet to respond to the internet community. I think you would be drawing a sharp distinction if the story was picked up in the New York Times and published to everyone as to whether or not he is a public figure in a media beyond the internet. And that's a distinction I'm not aware of any case ever drawn.
What's interesting is that I think Woody Allen's comment can be paraphrased. In the future, everyone will be a public figure for 15 minutes with the internet. When I said that all of us are reporters on the internet, all of us will probably also become public figures on the internet. What's interesting to see in the next 10 to 20 years is whether the law responds to this different dynamic. That the prototypical case is no longer the large media entity with large, significant financial resources and the ability to speak loudly and clearly across the nation versus a single plaintiff who has no access to the media to get his or her reputation corrected. We may find a leveling of the playing field and therefore a different paradigm with regard to libel law within 20 to 30 years, which I find to be a very interesting development.
If you're a public figure in cyberspace, cyberspace publication, are you perforce
a public figure in publication? I mean, for example, let's say that this whole scenario was covered by the Los Angeles Times Online, right? Well, public figure is about cyberspace, what have you. Now, if the Los Angeles Times Online took that same story and printed it in their print edition, same situation. I mean, do we still have a public figure? I mean, can we assume that because one is a public figure in cyberspace, that they will perforce be a public figure outside that realm? I mean, these questions are certainly ones that are likely to arise in any case of lightning.
It's been interesting to me that considering the enormity now of the amount of the speech, just the sheer volume of speech on the internet, that there has really been relatively little libel or invasion of privacy litigation. It's coming. We see it, we follow it, we're watching it sort of build. Much of the early litigation in the internet has been in trademark law, copyright law, intellectual property, and not in libel and privacy. But I was also quite astonished to realize in teaching a class of journalism students no more than a year ago, how few of them realized that the basic laws of libel and invasion of privacy apply not only to our conservative evangelists here, our moralists with a web page, but to their email, your email, back and forth. The libel law doesn't require this kind of publication. And I think as people begin to realize that the fundamental laws of libel and privacy, in fact, apply to this new medium, you're going to see a great deal more litigation. And some of the more esoteric issues that we're discussing, like who's a public figure, who's a private figure, which really can get very esoteric. You know, I wouldn't be worked out, but it's going to be worked out, I think, with a lot of very ordinary human beings in the litigation, unlike so much of the big media litigation, which involves big entities on both sides.
One last point, though, is like the internet does raise another spectrum, as was just mentioned, the advance in intellectual property law in terms of cross-border implications of being able to bring suits anywhere. I think libel may hit the same level, that when you publish something on the internet, are you publishing it all over the world with respect to libel?
There's another interesting issue that's implied, I think, in some of Sandy's comments, and that is the issue of what happens if libel law is extended to virtually everything on the internet, which it is, legally speaking. But we have been talking for the last 35 years in this country about a regime of constitutional law applicable to defamation, which turns upon a four-word statement, matter of public concern. New York Times versus Sullivan created a new constitutional rule where the press dealt with matters of public concern involving a public official and thereafter a public figure. Even Gertz, that 1974 U.S. Supreme Court case dealing with private individuals, stated a rule that at least required negligence on the part of the media before liability could be imposed involving a statement on a matter of public concern involving a private individual. What happens when the internet and email start generating things which clearly no court would look at as matters of public concern, but are simply gossip? At that point, we will find ourselves in British common law and the old days of presumed damages, strict liability, and a system of freedom of speech and freedom of the press that people would find astonishing, if in fact that is the way things go.
Bruce, one answer to the question, what will happen to our notion of matters of public concern? One thing that could happen is our whole notion of matters of public concern will change. In other words, it won't be what it once was. It may well be that when that phrase was first mentioned, the primary concern were political matters, that matters of entertainment weren't seen as matters of public concern. And what may well happen is that our whole notion of that concern.
There's a case pending in the New York Court of Appeals right now which deals with a related issue, the Chapado gross irresponsibility standard enunciated in New York, but it turns upon whether a media publication dealing with Hollywood stars' divorce or entertainment figures' divorce proceedings.
And whether or not it
she argues that the divorce implicated the question of whether black women are faring poorly under divorce law.
And the trial court, I think, or actually the appellate division, I think, said that that's not really a matter of public concern, that's simply a divorce. So there are some cracks in the system, and it's important to watch the developments as we move forward.
But I find something potentially troubling about all the comments that you've been making here. And I want to follow up on this. Are you not concerned with two implications that seem to flow from your comments? And Sandy, starting right out with your absolutely, you know, categorical answer that yes, this person would be a public figure. If that's so, then the more we have net public figures, that means that we have much less net liable, right? And then one follows from, one can call upon the rest of what you said about the distinction between the public figure of this conservative moralist on the net versus the fact that he would not be a public figure in the traditional press. I mean, is it not unseemly that we could have the New York Times Online law of libel versus the New York Times print law of libel with respect to this very gentleman in this scenario? I mean, are we going to develop two different bodies of law in libel depending on the media involved?
I don't want to be too categorical about my answer to that. I think the reason this gentleman is easy in a sense is that to be a public figure, among other things, inserting oneself into a controversy of the day, which this gentleman has done, is generally one of the criteria for a public figure. I think that's going to translate from the web to the newspaper, and that if an issue is of sufficient energy and controversy, that it migrates from a website to New York Times Online to New York Times in print, I think the analysis is going to hold up. I think it's because it has generated sufficient heat and weight that he's going to be a public figure up and down the line. I do think, however, looking at some of these cases that are coming up, that the issues are so slight that only on the internet are people getting exercised about it. And you may find a new body of law that says, that does distinguish someone, can be a public figure for purposes of controversy that is uniquely interesting on the internet, but really has not the same kind of juice when you get out of the community authority. I think it's possible.
From a more practical perspective, the way I see the law evolving is, I don't know what my own personal opinion is, that everything has become an issue of public concern. I can't think of anything right now that isn't an issue of public concern. So virtually everyone, as was just pointed out, is going to be a public figure before a particular moment.
Can you really defame someone on the internet who's internet tag is nasty ass 45.
can I introduce, because I know this panel's interested in it, and maybe they will give me a little, which is something we've touched on some of these others, which is the international aspects of this. Amazon.com, for example, is in litigation right now in England over a book about Northern Ireland. It was offered on Amazon.com UK as well as Amazon.com US. It's clearly a book that can be made available in all units. It's under litigation in Washington, D.C. But the litigation against Amazon.com UK, I guess, or .UK, whatever the heck it is much more dangerous. And I believe Amazon.com for a while pulled the book off of their list. There's a scientist in England who's taken to suing everyone who he provokes fights, and then people say things about it, and then he sues them. And he sued, in fact, a student at the University of Cornell, or Cornell University, I'm sorry, as well as, I think, the University of Minnesota. I don't remember all the people he sued, but he sued people all over the world. The UK courts took jurisdiction. The student at Cornell said, took it to book, as he commanded. But query how all of this internationalization of communication and literary commerce is going to affect the law of libel. And I know Bruce has views on this, so I can't resolve them.
There's another interesting Amazon.com story, and that is that Amazon.com is in trouble, or got in trouble in Germany, because there's a law against selling Mein Kampf. You can purchase it on Amazon.com even if you are accessing it from Germany. So for a while, I think Amazon tried to figure out how to sell Mein Kampf to various people without running afoul of German law, and it's impossible really to conduct business on the internet on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. So we may find ourselves with the least common denominator. One other area of internet liability, which I think is worth touching upon, is privacy law. We've seen in the last several weeks some lawsuits against Real Networks, another Seattle company, arising out of alleged invasions of privacy, dealing with the use of data compiled through, essentially click-through by customers. I think that's one of the areas where you're really going to see major litigation on the internet. Not so much defamation, since we will all be public figures for 15 minutes, but really privacy. And there are discussions going on right now between the European Union and the United States over the extent to which the European Union's data directive, which prohibits the collection of certain information about individuals, will be enforced or enforceable against American companies. The consequence of failing to achieve an agreement will be a trade war. So I fully expect to see an agreement by the end of the year. But you may see European attitudes towards privacy being imposed upon American companies. Anyone who's seen Jennycam knows that Americans have a slightly different attitude towards privacy than Europeans, perhaps because we have to pay our way through college, and therefore having a Jennycam may be a useful way to do it. But we will find ourselves dealing with very different issues in privacy than what we're used to in the area of libel. And I fully expect to see the privacy issues being litigated rather thoroughly in the next several years.
We tend to think of the internet as exporting First Amendment values for the whole world, as if somehow the whole world would accept our First Amendment perspective on life. And yet, from the comments you've heard today, it could work just the other way. In other words, we could be importing the common law and statutory law in terms of other countries, in terms of the policy decisions that internet service providers make as to what they will or will not allow to appear on their website.
That's a big point. One thing that you hear interesting on this panel is a lot of the people who represent the media companies have been spending a lot of time overseas. And putting on my other hand, my intellectual property practice hat, that area has developed much more vigorously in the international arena. We have the Berne Convention. We have a number of conventions and treaties that are attempting to create a international view of copyright protection and trademark protection that will be recognized throughout the world. And I think that maybe a fruitful area in the near future will try to get libel laws, notions of speech and protection of speech, which to me are almost co-commitments with notions of intellectual property similarly protected by international treaties.
Every practicing lawyer has a law review article that he or she wishes he could someday sit down and write. Mine has always been an article which would argue that New York Times versus Sullivan flowed directly from a 1946 U.S. Supreme Court case, International Shoe versus the State of Washington. In the 19th century, we had concepts of jurisdiction which were very geographically limited, and the New York Times could not be found in the state of Alabama to be sued under Annoyer versus Neff. But under the long-arm statute in New York Times versus Sullivan, under the long-arm statute in International Shoe versus the State of Washington, even with 13 copies of the New York Times available in Alabama, even with a policy by the New York Times not to allow any correspondent to go within the state of Alabama was able to assert jurisdiction over this New York institution. It does call to mind the House Divided speech of 1860 by Abraham Lincoln. Once we became a union, we actually had, to one degree or another, to develop a case law which would be applicable to all of us. And with International Shoe, peculiarities of Alabama law or of Alabama views about civil rights became national problems. I fully expect to see the same principle applied, either for good or for ill, in the international arena in the next 30 years.
Thank you. With that last comment, eloquent comment, and totalizing comment that brings your first year of law school back to you. This portion of our program, the roundtable discussion, will end. But before we begin questions from the audience, which can go on for 15 minutes, after which there will be a press conference and people associated with the law need to speak to panelists as well, let me ask you to give a healthy round of applause for this extreme... As you see, we have microphones here at your disposal. Please come up to them and to ask your questions.
My name's Pat Lyons. I'm a retired attorney. I'm a friend of Bruce's, and we like to sometimes compete with how far we can push the clock back. I have a statement first, but not a question. I want to. Bruce pushed his inspiration back 25 years. I want to go back 240 years when a young reporter wrote an article that said, among other things, that the British governor of Massachusetts had bad breath. And the young attorney, Andrew Hamilton, argued to the jury it was true. And the judge instructed the jury that truth is no defense to libel. That was the law at the time. And the real heroes in the case was the American jury, who said this is nonsense, and acquitted the defendant, who was Peter Zenger. Yes.
An early example in New York of jury nullification.
But there's where I get my inspiration. Now my question. I miss Senator Proxmire, and I miss the Golden Fleece. And the Golden Fleece, this is a young audience, so... Proxmire used to award a Golden Fleece to people who had government grants and did silly things with them, or at least he thought they did silly things with them, like, you know, go to Hawaii and look at snails or something and eat them or whatever. And he stopped doing it long before he stopped being a senator. The reason was that these people getting government money were usually private figures, you know, just some guy in a university, a professor who's private. And I've always... and it sort of relates to what you were talking about. Always seemed to me that the law of libel was a little bit overbroad, and that you ought to at least look at what private people do with public money when you give it, and maybe you don't make your inquiry go any further. I mean, sort of like what you're talking about on the internet. Can you get steers of liability? Certainly, it's in the public interest to know what people are doing with the grant money. Some of it's quite considerable. The public figure law ought to apply at least in that narrow space, not go any further. So my question is, if we could write down the law of libel with all its ambiguities and its future developments and call it a statute, would it meet Supreme Court requirements for narrowness, failure to be overbroad and vague? And has anyone raised this question?
Well, among the various doctrines in libel, the question of who's a public figure and who isn't, I think is one of the messiest and murkiest. There are cases, by the way, I'm not sure I can cite it to you right now, but where people who are participating in public projects, an architect hired to design public buildings, a psychologist hired to review the case of a particular child for custody dispute, has been held to be at least a public official, if not a public figure. But to answer your question specifically, the Supreme Court has tried to identify what it thinks are the restrictions the First Amendment poses on libel law. Were a libel law drafted, they exceeded that. That is, that allowed public figure qualifications to apply beyond what the Supreme Court has indicated are sort of the limits, if you will. I'm putting this backwards. I think the court would say, fine, we're allowed to go beyond the First Amendment in terms of affording protections and the immunity. You're just not allowed to go in the other direction. So if you wanted to declare anyone who gets public money to be a public official or public figure, I don't think the Supreme Court would have an objection.
Unless, of course, you can make some argument that it ran afoul of some other without speaking.
Yeah, I have a question. It seems to me that the person there is so American as almost in green and out of pocket. And one of the big issues that has come up several times is the effect of international litigation on First Amendment values, First Amendment rights. Now, it seems to me that the First Amendment has got to have, in addition to its normative justifications, it's got to have instrumental justifications. Some effect it produces in the United States that we value that isn't being produced, say, in another country with a vibrant political culture like Germany or England, France. And I'd like to know what that effect of the First Amendment is. What do we have that they don't have? Because they don't have a First Amendment. And we all seem to be frightened by the idea that our First Amendment jurisprudence could be changed by application of their law.
Let me hazard a guess. I think clearly they are free societies as we are free societies, and there's a broad ambit to freedom which would encompass what is available in Germany and France, the newly developing countries in Eastern Europe, Japan even to some extent, Korea, and the United States, and other countries around the world. What is unique about this country is the freedom of association. De Tocqueville observed it in 1835 when he visited Jacksonian America. Americans form associations for virtually everything. The nonprofit sector is what I'm speaking of in large amount. People volunteer here. They do things that I see in very few other countries. I've had visitors come and be astonished at the amount of volunteer time that goes into projects here in Seattle. People who devote their resources to this. You simply don't have that voluntary sector for one reason or another in other societies. Because American capitalism is as strenuously capitalistic as it is, that voluntary sector is very important to our society, and I think it really does depend upon an ample First Amendment protections in order to survive and thrive.
To bring it to more of a libel perspective, I think it comes down to, I don't know how you prove this, the vigorousness of the debate. When the Bill Clinton-Lewinsky affair was going on, you always heard everyone in Europe saying, oh, this would never be such a media event in Europe. So yes, people are subject to, I think public officials in the United States are subject to a degree of scrutiny that they may not be subject to overseas. Is that a good thing? We tend to think it is. It may not be.
There's also the question of opinion. Americans take as given the right to express a lot of opinions. Some of them by secretive, some of them angry. If you look at European law, you'll see that there's a lot of legislation and case law that really puts the lid on opinion. I think Americans would find it very difficult, quite honestly, to accept some of the cultural norms of European and Asian, sure, but let's stick with European for the moment. First Amendment or free speech or lack of First Amendment or lack of free speech. But I agree with you. I think it's an interesting question that some scholars should take up, which is to look and see what specifically are the differences between us and them in terms of our press. I think it would go to the bigger, examination of public figures and public officials and to our ability to express the vehemence of our views.
And in all this, remember, particularly in a state like Washington, remember that we talk about First Amendment, that sometimes we shouldn't be too literal. Actually, our constitutional protections are First Amendment and its state counterpart, whatever Article 1, Section, whatever it is of the Washington Constitution, where state constitutions can be used to give a greater level of constitutional protection. So obviously, the First Amendment is just, in our federalist society, first tier or one of the tiers of protection. Ironically though, just in terms of our system and what we're exporting, one of the things that has not happened in the United States is something that takes the text of the First Amendment seriously. Congress shall make no law. It is, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, the making of the law that is problematic. Not that we'll make the law and then we'll litigate it after the fact. In other words, the First Amendment comes into play when you go into a courtroom. Au contraire,
It's supposed to come and play at the whole idea at the very level of a lawmaking process. And I wonder what sort of institutional checks we might one day have to somehow bring the First Amendment into the lawmaking process at the very first instance where the threat occurs. What could we do institutionally with the legislative process itself to begin to protect free speech values such that they don't have to be litigated after the fact?
We reached 2 o'clock, the end of our program. The press is invited to remain, and once again, please thank our guests for the press.